Good morning, everyone. Good morning to Westosha Central High School from Kenosha. Are you here? Could you stand up and we'll just say hi to you?
Wow,
what a group. Welcome. It's nice to have you here today. Justice Kroski, I believe, is meeting with you if you are able to stay after the second oral argument this morning. She won't talk to you about the case, but she can answer all your really tough questions, so feel free to ask her anything you'd like, okay? All right, go ahead and have a seat. State versus Daniel J. Van Lin, 19 AP, 1317 CR. Appearances, please. Great, thank you. The lineup's 25 minutes to start, followed by 30 minutes and 5 minutes of rebuttal. Okay, we have a little different light system here today, but it might actually even be clearer than the old one used to be, so we'll see how that goes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Sigler, and may it please the court. This case presents a novel sequence of events, but the governing law has been around for quite a while. The independent source notion was first mentioned in 1920 in Silverthorne Lumber, and in 1988 in Murray, the Supreme Court laid out a little bit more clearly the rules. It said that a later warrant could be independent of a prior illegal search if, and this is a quote, no information gained from the illegal entry affected the law enforcement officer's decision to seek a warrant. And it also said, this is another quote, what counts is whether the actual illegal search had any effect in producing the warrant. Here, the prosecutor said on the record that the subpoena became necessary because the illegal search was suppressed. He also knew what the results of the hospital test would be because of the results of the illegal search. If we take the Supreme Court and the prosecutor at their word, there can't really be an argument that the illegal search and its results did not affect the decision to seek a subpoena here.
Counsel, I think that the way the question is framed can be outcome determinative here. How do you frame the legal issue? What's the question?
The question is whether a state representative acting in the knowledge of the proceeds, the fruits, the what was turned up by an illegal search, and knowing what he or she is going to find, whether the action of seeking some judicial blessing for seeking the same result is an independent source. In other words, in some sense, the question is whether the subpoena here sort of launders the ill-gotten information from the illegal blood draw.
What was your verb sort of? I didn't hear that.
Launders. Cleans up.
Okay.
Now, the state has offered a few reasons why they believe that that the subpoena should qualify as an independent source, but they're not convincing. First of all, they point to all the facts that establish probable cause for a blood draw. And of course, in any case in which a warrant or a subpoena requiring probable cause is offered as an independent source, there is by definition going to be probable cause. Otherwise, the subpoena or the warrant would be no good, and we wouldn't be arguing about where it was derived from. And it's clear from Murray that the question is not sort of this objective, was there enough probable cause in the air to generate an independent source? The question is a subjective one. Murray talks about if the agent's decision to seek the warrant was prompted by what they learned from their illegal search. In footnote 2, it says that we're not just going to rely on the word of the officers. If it's implausible, then that's not going to be determinative. Again, this suggests a subjective test. And it also says what counts is whether, again, the actual illegal search had any effect in producing the warrant. It refers later to fact-finding and the government's concession that fact-finding wasn't made. And even the dissent in Murray regards the question as being a subjective one.
I have a question.
Do we need to be, I know you've argued it as independent source, but in looking at these cases discussing independent source, they all deal with the same evidence. They deal with the marijuana that was seen in the warehouse first, and then they went back and were able to get to it again a different way. But it's the same marijuana sitting in the same warehouse. In all those cases, Silverthorne, Murray, this case to me seems a little bit different because you're not trying to get the draw of the blood that was illegally taken from the officers. That's not the evidence you're trying to get again. You're trying to get the evidence that was taken separately at a different time by maybe the same tech or maybe not the same tech, but a different vial of blood taken by a different entity. So is it really, do we need the independent source doctrine to get to the end result that you're asking us for? Should we be looking at the independent source doctrine at all?
Well, I think that the state needs the independent source doctrine. I don't need it.
No, but why does the state need it? So there's a non-government entity that took this individual's blood for a medical purpose. You need probable cause for a subpoena, that's clear. But why do we need to, I mean, just because that one was suppressed, I guess, help me with the link between
sure.
the two.
Sure. So I guess it's important to take a step back and recognize that the independent source doctrine is not sort of a standalone doctrine. It's an exception to the fruit of the poisonous tree rule,
right.
I think there's a couple of facts in this case that can be sort of, they can draw the attention, but they're not necessarily, aren't really the facts that are doing the work here. One of those facts is the fact that you point out that, in fact, physically there are two different vials of blood that we're talking about, taken at different times. I'd point out that in Murray, the court said, the knowledge that marijuana was in the warehouse was acquired twice, first via the illegal search and second via the warranted search. And so it's not determinative. The point is that the information became available through an illegal search initially. But beyond that, it's very often the case in fruit of the poisonous tree cases that we're not talking about pieces of evidence that are even remotely alike. Suppose there's a bank robbery and police come to suspect that the robber lives in a particular address. They go in there illegally, there's no one home, they don't get a warrant, they find a map, and the map leads them to the proceeds of the robbery buried in a field. Now, the map is not the same thing as the proceeds of the robbery, but the fact that one led to the other and they wouldn't have found it otherwise makes it the fruit of the poisonous tree. I guess as long as we're on this topic, I'd add, I think, although we are talking about a subpoena here, which I think is legally indistinguishable from a warrant in this instance, the fact that it's a subpoena or the fact that it's a warrant is not terribly relevant to this case. And the reason for that is the warrant adds the second prong of the Murray test, which is the question of whether the magistrate would have issued the warrant or subpoena. The first prong is the only prong that we have a disagreement about, and that's the question of the decision to seek. So the question of decision to seek the warrant is really not different from the decision to seek the proceeds of the robbery in a farmer's field.
So to follow up on that, what the state says is, I'm paraphrasing here, even an officer on their first day would know that this guy was intoxicated and that there was probable cause to get the blood. And on page 11 of their brief, they spell out Van Lin had four priors, so his BAC, right, that the limit is a .02, very, very low, so he was subject to the reduced prohibited alcohol concentration. Third, he'd driven off the road at bar time, confused the tree he struck for another vehicle, slammed his SUV into a building. Four, immediately fled from the scene, lied to the police about his involvement in the crash. Five, smelled of alcohol during police contact. Six, admitted to drinking. Seven, refused a blood test upon request. So they say, this is what they relied on. This is what they were prompted by, to use the Murray language. What's your response to that?
I have a couple of responses. First of all, we concede that there was probable cause. That's not at issue here. I think, the state is presenting the strongest possible version of the facts. Of course, the person had been in a car crash. He may well have had a concussion. There are reasons that could explain you know, some of the ways in which he seemed to be intoxicated. Nevertheless, there was probable cause. The thing about the Murray test is, again, that it's a question about what would have happened subjectively, factually. And we know what happened here. And it's not that the prosecutor said, oh, look at all these facts, or the police officer said, look at all these facts, and told the prosecutor, hey, we should get a subpoena for the hospital records. What happened, pardon, is that, of course, they performed the unlawful blood draw that was suppressed, and only after it was suppressed did the prosecutor seek the subpoena.
Now, but why would they seek the subpoena until they had the ruling on suppression? If the court had ruled the other way, then they'd have the evidence. The court ruled differently, excluded the evidence, so they pursued the other avenue, which, to my colleague's points I think they're making in questioning to you, it was obvious, it was there. If the police officer hadn't ordered the blood draw, I mean, are you really arguing that no one would have thought to subpoena the hospital blood draw?
I mean, I've been doing this for a while, and I haven't seen, I don't think ever, a hospital subpoena for blood draw results. But to get, I guess, more specifically and answer your question, I agree with you that the prosecutor sought these results after the suppression, and it's pretty clear why he did it, and he basically said why he was doing it. It was because of the suppression. And it's that timing, that sequence of events that shows that his knowledge that he would find this information in the hospital sample led him to make that request, which is what makes it the fruit of the poisonous tree.
But arguably, that's not what led to the request. It was the court ruling. I mean, it seemed, based on the facts as presented to us, it seems pretty obvious that both blood draws are probably going to show that he was intoxicated.
I guess I would push back again on the idea that it was certainly going to happen that he was going to seek these results, given these circumstances. And in fact, again, this is a question of fact, a subjective question, and we can see what happened, which is that it was only once the prosecutor knew of the whatever the result was that he decided to seek this subpoena. I understand you pointing out that he additionally was prompted by the fact of suppression, and that created a need for him. But the need for him was combined with this understanding that he had from the illegal search.
But following up on Justice Dalit's earlier question, this is two different samples, and so it strikes me this really isn't the fruit of the poisonous tree because we have two separate trees, don't we?
No, I don't think they're two separate trees. The if we're going to get into tree metaphors,
the case is useful.
The knowledge of what the sample contained is the trunk of the tree, I would say, and that's what led to acquiring the hospital sample. I mean, you can think about what would have happened if, contrary to the officer's expectations, the illegal blood draw had come back showing that there was nothing to seek. Then, of course, the prosecutor would never have sought a subpoena. I don't think. The state suggests he would, but I can't imagine why.
Counsel, wouldn't that have been an extremely unlikely circumstance here, given the repetitive drunk driving convictions that your client had, such that he needed only a 0.02 alcohol concentration to violate the law?
I mean, obviously, again, we're conceding that there is probable cause. And what I'm pointing to, again, in response to your question, is that the circumstances, in fact, were not that the prosecutor saw these facts and went ahead and got a subpoena. It was only later, and only once he knew what the results would contain.
But I don't.
I guess I'm offering it as a hypothetical. I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah. I guess my question to you is that this particular person, to some degree, stands in a different shoe than someone who's never been convicted of drunk driving and has no limitation and can go up to a 0.08 before they end up driving intoxicated, where your client, if he got to 0.02, he violated the law. And so I think that there's a lot more leeway in the officers making a decision. I mean, he couldn't, there's no reason why he would ask for the hospital's blood sample if the blood sample that was initially taken was not suppressed. So I agree with Justice Bradley on that. But also, I don't think he had to know the results of that test in order to ask for the second one, given the low level of
alcohol concentration that your client could maintain and not break the law.
Well, I agree with that last statement, certainly. There was probable cause for both of these. There was probable cause for the unlawful search.
Yeah.
Could have gotten a warrant, and we wouldn't be here. There was probable cause for the subpoena. But again, the 000, whether it's likely to have happened or not, the point is that we can see from that, considering that hypothetical, that the true results must have influenced the decision of the prosecutor to seek the subpoena.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, would you address the policy behind the exclusionary rule? Obviously, we're in the world of remedy here, right? So the fruit of the poisonous tree is a question of how far the remedy of exclusion is going to go. The remedy of exclusion is aimed at deterring police misconduct. That's its sole purpose under the law. And so this is a bit of a back, you know, coming in from the other angle to analyze this question. But I think it's relevant when we're talking about these, the extent of these doctrinal categories, that we look at the policy behind it to help us figure out whether we're drawing the right limits or not. So would you address that? How does your position deter police misconduct? Respond to what you think your opponent may say about that.
Sure. I guess there are a few angles I agree with which to look at this. First of all, and I want to be very clear about this, the misconduct that we're talking about here is the failure to seek a warrant when exigent circumstances were not present. Although we have a subsequent actor in this case, the prosecutor making the decision to seek the subpoena, that is not the wrongdoing that we are seeking to deter. The wrongdoing, that is simply sort of the causal step that gets us into the fruit of the poisonous tree world. I know that my opponent has relied heavily on the notion, policy notion, that the point of the, or at least the limit of the exclusionary rule, is that it is intended to put the government in the same position that it would be had there been no wrongdoing, rather than a worse position. I guess I'll start by offering the caveat that that's clearly not always the case. Very often the government suffers for its wrongdoing in a Fourth Amendment violation case. If an officer breaks into a house without a warrant, seizes marijuana, that marijuana is not going to be introduced. If he had followed the law, it would be introduced. So the government is in a worse place. The independent source doctrine and the related inevitable discovery doctrine are sort of escape valves for the government, where we say if the evidence that is sought to be suppressed is sufficiently independent from the violation, then we don't suppress them. But I agree with Your Honor's statement that the policy or the notion of the government not being placed in a worse position, being placed in the same position, is the policy justification of the independent source doctrine. It is not the rule of the doctrine itself. The rule of the doctrine is independence. The Supreme Court cites that same policy justification both with regard to independent source and with regard to inevitable discovery. But then it lays out what the rules are. And in this case, the rule, again, is what counts is whether the actual legal search had any effect in producing the warrant. And I guess to continue on the policy front, I think this court does need to consider, you know, what will be the results of its decision if it announces that in circumstances like these, an unlawful search can always essentially be remedied by the government by seeking blood from the hospital. I don't see that can do anything to deter illegal searches. The police officer has nothing to lose by doing an unlawful search.
Can I push back on that for a second?
Sure.
I mean, they have no idea what the hospital did or didn't test for. Now, likely the hospital tested for blood alcohol, concentration of drugs and alcohol, but that would be pretty risky for the police in the future to just rely on what the hospital may or may not have done, wouldn't it?
Well, the hospital may or may not have done it. I agree with you that it's a pretty typical sort of test to do. And I guess my answer to that would be, you know, from the police officer's point of view, you know, why not both? Belt and suspenders. If he can take a sample that he thinks, oh, this is borderline, but I don't really, you know, I don't want to go through the effort of trying to get a warrant. So I'm just going to do it. And I know that, you know, if it turns out that a judge later says I was wrong, well, we're not really going to suffer. I think I've covered most of what I'd like to cover, so in the absence of further questions,
I have one other question for you. In your briefing, you rely heavily, of course, on the Silverthorne decision, but in that seminal case, the court said that the government was seeking to maintain its right to avail itself of the knowledge obtained by that means which otherwise it would not have had. I don't see how that fits your situation, because there were other means by which the government could obtain the knowledge it had eventually acquired, because there was a second blood draw, because that was not the blood draw that was obtained by the police officer, but it was the blood draw that the hospital did for treatment purposes. So there was other means by which the government could obtain the knowledge it ended up getting, which was the BAC level. So I don't see how Silverthorne fits your situation.
Well, I don't know that Silver... I mean, I suppose Silverthorne is technically a fruit of the poisonous tree case. Having looked fairly closely at that case and tried to find out more information that is available than is available in the opinion, it was difficult to find out. So I don't know whether the officers who conducted that initial clean sweep of the business records, whether they could in fact have gotten a warrant if they had probable cause to do so. But again, I would just reply in I guess similar to the way that I replied before, which is that I'm not criticizing the hospital for having drawn this blood. I'm not criticizing really anyone. I'm not saying anyone did anything wrong with the exception of the police officer, and that the knowledge obtained by that illegal search is what led the state to know that they could find the same information in the hospital sample.
Anything further from the bench? All right. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. Mr. Van Lin's argument has come a long way since he was before the Circuit Court, where he argued that his medical records were inadmissible because they were privileged, gathered outside of Wisconsin's implied consent law, and an unfair bypass of the Circuit Court's prior exclusionary decision. While the Court of Appeals declined to apply forfeiture here, we are effectively arguing about an issue that was never presented to the Circuit Court, and that is whether the exclusionary rule should bar admission of evidence that was created and retained wholly independent of government action and derived from a blood sample that would have been drawn from Mr. Van Lin even if police had never ordered a warrantless blood draw. I'm asking that you affirm the Court of Appeals because they properly applied the independent source doctrine to this case and recognize that the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine did not apply. And there are two main reasons why the court should do that. First and foremost, we've talked about two distinct pieces of evidence that provided different information. And under the prevailing two-prong test laid out in Murray, the medical records that Van Lin sought to suppress were derived from an independent source, not the fruit of the poisonous tree. Second, the exclusionary rule's intent is to put the state in the same, not a worse position, that had no government misconduct occurred. That's not what suppression would do in this case. To adopt Van Lin's argument is to impose an arbitrary cutoff that basically bars the state from engaging in any additional investigation once it suffers its first negative or adverse suppression ruling.
Counsel, isn't it true that sometimes when you exclude the fruit of the poisonous tree, it does not put the government in the same place? I mean, I get the first part of your argument, but I'm having trouble with the second. Sometimes the government is put in a worse place because of misconduct of an officer, perhaps, such as in this case, where a warrant should have been obtained but was not.
I guess it theoretically can put the state in a worse place, but that's what the independent source doctrine and the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine are intended to at least protect, is the state's ability to pursue a case notwithstanding the fact that there was some government error, some government misconduct. And I can't state it enough that this case does involve two separate pieces of evidence that were gathered at two different times by two different entities for two different purposes. And in Murray, basically Murray should guide this court in deciding that the independent source doctrine aptly applies here, because this wasn't the fruit of the poisonous tree. As one of my colleagues so eloquently put it, this isn't even growing from the same plant. This isn't even growing in the same yard as the poisonous tree. It is.
Well, let's see if it's a twig from the trunk of the And so, of course, the poisonous tree doctrine deals with tainting, which means permeating, not just a direct causal effect, but it can be an indirect. Well, do you agree with me? It can be an indirect taint also?
I agree, I think that there are circumstances when we think of the traditional fruit of the poisonous tree. Council brought up, one of the more customary ones that we think of. You know, the police do an unlawful search, and then that leads them into a different direction that maybe allows them to continue their investigation by investigating other leads that wouldn't have otherwise have been apparent. That's not the case here. For starters, Mr. Van Lin has never argued or disputed that when you excise that single reference to his second blood draw from the subpoena affidavit, that there was certainly more than enough information that pointed anyone that read those documents to see that Mr. Van Lin was intoxicated and would have an unlawful blood alcohol concentration. You don't have to be particularly savvy to recognize that when an individual with four prior OWIs drives off the road for 50 to 75 yards, crashes into a building at bar time, smells of alcohol, refuses a blood draw, claims he's just out for a stroll that morning, it's highly likely that that individual, any samples of blood drawn from that individual, are going to show that he was driving drunk. What remains is whether, absent this unlawful search, the state would have sought out Van Lin's medical records. Obviously, that's the heart of this case, and this is where the parties admittedly deviate rather significantly in their analysis. Mr. Van Lin is focused much of his argument on the timing of the state's request, given the fact that the state did not seek out this particular these particular records until after the suppression hearing occurred.
It was about 3 months afterwards, 2.5 to 3 months afterwards, as I calculated.
I believe so.
Yes. One of my concerns is coming up with a test, and I'm having difficulty doing that. Your opposing counsel emphasizes the knowledge in giving that hypothetical of illegal entry to find a map that ultimately led to the money being hidden in the field. Your opposing counsel says the knowledge obtained by the illegal search is what led them to know they would find the same thing from the hospital sample. So it's emphasizing knowledge. Is that part of your focus?
I think to an extent the knowledge is a consideration. I think the bigger thing here about this case, and again, how you differentiate it from the traditional fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, is that this wasn't a situation where, absent this unlawful search, the police would have never discovered a map. They never would have ultimately have come upon this additional lead. This case doesn't fit that mold in any way, though. But for the fact that there was an unlawful search, and I think an example of this could be, had police never responded to the hospital, had they simply written up their reports and indicated, look, these were the observations that we had that led us to believe that he was impaired, but we didn't go to the hospital and get a blood draw, or alternatively, when the deputy speaks with his lieutenant, if they decided, look, we can't do a warrantless blood draw under exigent circumstances, I guess we can't get blood. If that were the case here, and there was no additional information, to say that the prosecutor or the state would have just taken these reports, realized he received medical treatment for his injuries, and just throw their hands up in the air and suggest, well, I guess we're out of luck, it doesn't make sense. And I think I was going to say, I think if there's one major takeaway that I hope the court takes away from my argument here, is that a blood draw, the warrantless blood draw that was induced by police, neither the act of drawing that blood nor the testing of that blood would reveal to anyone that a separate blood draw was done by hospital staff 20 minutes earlier or necessarily what those results would have been.
Let me... I have read many of the cited cases and spent a lot of time doing that. I've read the cases focusing on what was the question, how was it framed, and oftentimes find, not surprisingly so, it's framed in the context of the facts of that case, right? And so there's a lot of argument here, a lot of cases to review and to nuance what is the test, but there's for me a threshold response also. It's the response of the prosecutor in this case. Would you have sought the diagnostic information, blood draw, if the search had been deemed legal? And the response, in essence, and of course it flies off the paper here, of course they wouldn't have tried. If they didn't have an illegal blood draw, they wouldn't have 3 months later tried to get a subpoena for the results from the hospital. Of course. I mean, do you disagree with that?
Not necessarily. I do understand the prosecutor's position on that. And there's a couple things at play. First of all, just because the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene or the crime lab tests a sample and confirms this is the result, that doesn't make that unassailable evidence by any means. There are certainly challenges that get mounted to that evidence. And having a separate blood sample or a separate result that shows, look, we have two samples taken within 20 minutes apart and they are consistent with one another, would absolutely be valuable at trial. Now, I can't speak for every prosecutor and what they would do under those circumstances. But even if a prosecutor decided, no, I'm not going to do that because I already have this good piece of evidence, I mean, that makes sense. They had a piece of evidence that would seem to suggest guilt, and the fact that they didn't potentially look for other pieces of evidence right away doesn't change the fact that under this test, under Murray, the question is not whether they would have sought out evidence if there was an adverse suppression decision, but whether they would have sought out this evidence but for the unlawful search. So if we go back to the point and assume that the officers never go to the hospital, they never get this blood sample, all they have are all these indicia that you can see from looking at him that he's clearly impaired and that he crashed his vehicle into a building. Where could we possibly go for a source of his blood alcohol concentration? Clearly the hospital that treated him. So that goes to show you this timing of this really shouldn't carry any weight. The bottom line is whether it would have made sense for them to be looking for this evidence and not being taken by some unlawfully gained evidence to develop some other type of lead and exploit that.
Counsel, I just heard you then come up with a test. And it was, would they have sought this evidence but for the illegal search? So you're positing a but-for test, is that right? Or is that not right? What you said. But
I wish
sure.
I could take credit for the United States Supreme Court analysis.
I know. I'm just asking what you're positive.
But I think that makes sense, and I will stick by the analysis that was laid down in Murray.
Well, in a number of cases that involve prohibited alcohol concentration issues, there are two ways for the state to get a conviction in these types of drunk driving cases. one, based upon the conduct of the driver, regardless of what their alcohol concentration is, although that can be some evidence to support it, or two, on the prohibited alcohol concentration charge alone. And there are various ways to defend against those things. What would otherwise preclude the state from wanting to introduce additional evidence of an alcohol concentration, even if it wasn't done in the traditional sense?
I just want to make sure I understand. So if
someone's attacking the curve or attacking the machine or saying, you know, because sometimes there are different numbers and
yes.
the argument is made, oh, well, here's this number, so it could have been off by this much, or here's this number. You have another piece of evidence to introduce to a jury. What would preclude the state, other than a judge precluding that evidence, what would preclude the state from obtaining that evidence and trying to introduce it in any ODFI, regardless of whether there's a blood analyst or a breath analyst?
I mean, I don't think there really necessarily would be. I'm thinking back to trying cases where there was just an OWI charge and maybe not a prohibited alcohol concentration that was detected in the blood draw. And the defense often does cry foul about what relevance does it have. But for me as a prosecutor to show that the reason why you're showing all these manifestations of intoxication is because of something you consumed and not from like a medical episode, that would be relevant and probative to whether you were actually impaired.
Right. I mean, blood test results otherwise may not be detecting alcohol. They might detect a different substance in someone's blood.
And they often do.
And affect the charges or affect the trial as well, right?
They often do.
I'm just trying to think of any doctrine in the law that would preclude the state from obtaining that from a medical person if, let's just say there's an accident, you're taken to the hospital, traditionally they draw blood. I'm trying to think of anything that would preclude the state from getting that and attempting to introduce that in a trial so the jury gets all the facts.
I don't believe so, and I think that scenario that you're describing goes to show kind of how ludicrous it would be to suppress the results in this particular case, given the fact that if the state would have, notwithstanding all the things that happened in this case, if they would have applied for the hospital records 2 weeks after his arrest instead of waiting an additional, say, several weeks until the hygiene lab reported those results, we wouldn't be here. And it goes to show you just how it does not flow from the illegality. I mean, it was just as common sense and obvious at the time of his arrest that what his blood would contain was evidence of his crime as it was a month later or 6 months later.
Mr. Callis, should we be concerned at all with what the impact of what you're asking us to do may have? So this is what I'm thinking. Why not get the warrant, right? There's not an easier warrant to get for sure in the state of Wisconsin than an OWI warrant. Every circuit court judge you talk to talks about their duty week and how they didn't get any sleep because they were up every night with OWI warrants. So they're not difficult to get, and certainly given these facts, right? Everyone admits there's probable cause, including Mr. Hinkle, right? No problem getting the warrant. So I'm just wondering if we find the way that you're asking us to do, is there any danger to police officers just saying we don't have to get warrants? We're just going to get the hospital blood. Forget warrants, and it's just an end around to having to get a warrant and to have an independent magistrate review the case and determine whether or not there's probable cause.
I don't think there's any danger, and I think the main reasoning for that is that the state is never going to be able to hospital records unless they establish probable cause. So there is going to be a magistrate involved in this. They're never going to gain possession of these hospital records unless it's judicially authorized. So there is that safeguard in place, just as there would have been if the officers would have applied for a search warrant. They're not going to gain this evidence improperly without judicial authorization.
I'd like to follow up on the line of questioning from the other Justice Bradley, who was talking about knowledge. And I'm going back to the Silverthorne case, which is now over 100 years old. So over 100 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court, the whole point of that case was to preclude the government from benefiting from the knowledge it had no other way of acquiring but through the unlawful conduct of the government. But that's not the case here at all, right? So if we're looking for a test, and going back to Justice Bradley's question, you know, what should the test be? We've kind of had it for 100 years, haven't we?
Yeah, I don't think that really we need to break any ground in this case. I don't think that any test really needs to deviate from this. I guess really what maybe, if anything, the circuit courts could use as guidance as to what it really means to influence a decision. Obviously, opposing counsel and I disagree on what it really means to influence. I mean, it seems that the Mr. Van Lin's position is basically, how could it not? If the state's aware of some evidence that was obtained unlawfully, how could it not influence the decision? And my rebuttal to that is, when you look at all the facts of this case, yes, there would have been probable cause to get a warrant, and that is going to be the case in any of these where a warrant could have been obtained but wasn't. But the bottom line is, it was common sense that the illegal alcohol concentration would be found. This isn't a situation where they looked at some illogical or I guess, innocent place to try to find some evidence based on an unlawful search. I mean, the whole reason why they ordered a warrantless blood draw in the first place is because they knew there'd be evidence there. And it just so happened that the hospital took additional evidence 20 minutes earlier, in which the state had no involvement in that, and that's what the state is entitled to use now.
Well, the defense concedes there was probable cause for the subpoena of the hospital blood record, and so, of course, we know here that the government, in fact, had an independent source, a separate tree, or whatever metaphor anyone wants to use. The government had that other knowledge, the facts and circumstances of the crash and the police's interaction with Mr. Van Lin, correct?
That's correct. And I really want to hit the point here that we need to consider what the purpose of the exclusionary rule is here, and it's to deter police conduct. Justice Hagedorn recognized that, and I want to...
Police misconduct.
What? I'm sorry. Well, police misconduct, yes. In this case, the police conduct that we're trying to discourage is basically an officer looking at all the situation, suspecting that there's insufficient time to get a warrant, given the fact that there had been a decent amount of time that had passed since a drunk driver crashed into a building, fled from the scene, was taken to a different hospital that was anticipated, and refused a blood draw. To the extent that this court views the officer's decision to go ahead with a warrantless blood draw in that case, if that's so reprehensible that it needs deterrence, I submit that exclusion of hospital blood results that came at a different time is not the way to achieve that goal. And as far as the deterrent effect, I know that there was a disagreement about this, and I know that Justice Dallet commented on this during or earlier today. As far as this being the means to send the signal or to send the point to the police officers that you can't just go off and do these warrantless blood draws with thinking that this is going to serve as an insurance policy, I maybe I'm wrong on this. I think it's ludicrous to think that police officers are put in this situation who are trying to think about, who are discussing these things with their superiors and trying to find out, do we have enough time to get a warrant, that they're going to be sitting here and thinking, well, if we don't do it, we can probably just get the hospital blood afterwards anyways. If that were the case, why would they ever order the warrantless blood draw? They would just direct their district attorney or speak with the district attorney about getting the hospital records after the fact. It wouldn't make sense that they would order the warrantless blood draw if that was on their mind all along. So with that, unless the court has any other questions, I'll cede the rest of my time But at the end, the Court of Appeals got it right here. And I'm asking that you affirm because the independent source doctrine provided for the state's use of his medical records in this case. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Rebuttal?
That look about right. I just have a few points to make in response to the state's argument, and so I apologize if it's a little scattershot. First of all, there was some suggestion in the argument that perhaps the initial search was not illegal. That has not been briefed, and I think the circuit court was correct in saying, listen, just the passage of time, there was no reason that you gave why you couldn't have sought a warrant. The same thing is true with respect to forfeiture. That wasn't argued in the briefing. And furthermore, if you look at the trial record, particularly record number 27, which is the initial motion to quash, and then I believe it's record number 32, which is the defendant's brief in support of suppression, you'll see that while, you know, may not frame the argument in exactly the terms that the appellate lawyer ends up using, I mean, he is talking about the subpoena being derived from the illegal search, that, you know, he's talking about the Fourth Amendment, the exclusionary rule, the purposes of the exclusionary rule. I don't believe there was a forfeiture here. And if it was, the argument that there was has been forfeited by now.
Counsel, don't be concerned about that. We're very accustomed to a case changing from when it starts out at the circuit court.
I was going to say, we're all appellate lawyers here. We know how it goes. With respect to some of the hypotheticals that the state introduced, and also I think this is in response to some of Chief Justice Ziegler and Justice Bradley's concerns, I do think that those are illuminating. I agree with the state that if the district attorney had decided to seek a subpoena before the results came back from the hygiene lab, then we probably wouldn't be here. It's the significance of the timing here is that it is evidence of the motivation of the prosecutor. Which again is the inquiry that Murray directs us to make. What would have happened?
Oh, can I ask about that? The evidence, you said the evidence of motivation of the prosecutor. Aren't we supposed to look and focus more on the motivation of the police officers? I mean, if we're trying to deter the conduct of the police officers, shouldn't that be where the focus is? And then why does the timing matter as much?
Again, the wrongful conduct that we're talking about is the initial illegal blood draw.
Right.
The fact that the causal chain goes through, you know, the mental process of another human being doesn't make it not a causal chain. I don't really think that it has too much to do with deterrence. The question is, again, did the state benefit from this illegal blood draw? And that's it. And whether they benefit, you know, via some chain of reasoning on the part of the police or chain of reasoning on the part of a prosecutor doesn't matter. Usually the prosecutor is not involved in these cases because usually these are things that are happening quickly on the ground before there's even a charge.
So if that's the only question, if the state benefited from the illegal blood draw, then how do you fit an independent source into that? Because the state would always benefit from the illegal information, but then we have independent source.
Right. The independent source, again, is an exception to the general rule that they can't benefit from that illegal information, but it requires true independence, which our position is that is not here.
Do you think we're changing the test then for suppression to be sort of this collective knowledge of all working on behalf of the prosecution?
No, I think the test is always the test. The test is always, did A lead to B? Sometimes it's, did A lead to D through B and C? And B and C can be the decisions of police officers. B and C can be the decisions of other people in the legal system. The question is, did A cause D? Did the beginning contribute or bring about or affect the end? The last thing I'd like to say is just point out that I don't think it's quite true that that a prosecutor could never obtain hospital blood records without probable cause. It's true that you can obtain a subpoena without probable cause because that's what our statutes require. But there's no requirement for probable cause of simply, you know, summoning a witness to a trial. And the Wisconsin statutes that provide protection to medical records don't apply here to tests of intoxication. So it may, you know, it may not be an everyday occurrence, but I do not think it is correct that probable cause would always be required for a prosecutor to get hospital records. If there's nothing further, I will retire.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for your briefs and arguments this morning. The court will reconvene for the second oral argument this morning, giving one group from this high school the chance to leave and a new group from this high school the chance to come back in. So a lot of Kenosha today. I love it. Good to see you all.